Dog Works Radio Network presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Forto. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Forto.
Hello and welcome, everybody. You are listening to Mushing Radio here on KVRF 89.5 in the Matsu Valley. RadioFreePalmer.org is our live streaming site, and you can find all of our episodes over on iTunes. Just search for Dog Works Radio, as well as on Facebook and Twitter. Just search for the same thing, Dog Works Radio. Today we're continuing our Iditarod Musher series, and we're talking to Mike Santos. He is calling in from Cantwell, Alaska, which is about, maybe 200 miles or so north of the original restart in Willow. So we're going to bring him up right now. Mike, how's it going? Mike, can you hear me?
Yes. Yeah, very good, Robert. How are you?
I am well, thank you. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself, who you are, and what you're all about, please?
Oh, well, I'm just, I like to tell folks that I was born Alaskan in the wrong state. Mostly 99% dogs and running sled dogs, and the rest of it, just enjoy the Alaskan lifestyle.
We're going to talk about the Iditarod in just a second, but I want to talk about where you live, if we can, for just a minute. My daughter was just up there a couple of months ago for the Junior Iditarod, which runs right in your backyard there along the Denali Highway. Can you tell us about Cantwell, where it's at, how far it is from quote-unquote civilization, and what you do there to make sure that you and your teams get the best training possible?
Well, you know, we many, many years ago, my wife sent me to Alaska on a dog shopping trip, and I was fortunate enough to meet at the time still some of the best dog drivers in the state, and actually got stuck in Cantwell for 3 days, believe it or not, and called, you know, after getting to know the locals and getting familiar with the area, called the wife and said, hey, you know, I found home. And big part of that, the reasoning behind that was that it is the ideal place to be if you want to be in the sled dog racket. We are pretty much at the height of land, what is called Broad Pass, just on the south side of the Alaskan Range. So we are blessed with quite a bit of early snow, and we tend to keep our snow pretty late into the season. We have infinite numbers of miles of training possibilities, so it is by far the ideal place to be if you want to be in the sled dog game. So we sort of live in paradise here. The remoteness of it is always a little bit more challenging. We certainly aren't as remote as any of the communities that are off the road system, but about as far away as you can get and still be connected by the road system.
You know, in this year and in the last couple of years, snow has been pretty scarce, especially as you have traveled down south. And pretty much everybody is heading up to your neck of the woods to get in all those training miles. You had mentioned the early snow and of course, how long it stays there on the ground. When do you guys typically get on sleds, and when are you off of them?
You know, it really varies from year to year, but, very, very rarely are we not able to run a sled by the 1st of December somewhere, you know, some size teams. And we still have enough snow here to run as many dogs as you want. So, yeah, we got plenty of snow still on the ground.
So before we talk about Iditarod, Mike, let's talk a little bit about your tour business. I'm sure that's how you pay the bills in the off season, and it gets a lot of the training miles on your dogs. Tell us about it. What is its name, and what do you offer?
Yeah, so Doggone It Tours, and we are sort of a startup. We've only been doing tours officially for the last couple of years. This is sort of a big make-or-break summer for us. But we offer kennel tours, which include visiting with puppies, about a 45-minute demonstration presentation out in the dog yard, and get a chance to see the dog team leave. Then my wife takes you basically through the dog's entire life cycle from puppyhood all the way up through retirement. the different phases of their lifestyle, and basically our lives with them. We utilize throughout our tour a lot of multimedia things such as video as well as still pictures. So while folks are out in the dog yard, they actually get a chance to kind of check in with the team while the team is out on a training run, so they get a chance to kind of get a virtual ride. And then we have a state-of-the-art, what I call a Yukon River roundhouse. It was built after the roundhouses or community centers that are, you know, that dot many of the native villages on the Yukon. And it has a 10-foot 6-by-6-foot movie screen. And then we specifically talk more about the Iditarod and about racing sled dogs. And again, that utilizes multimedia with stage lighting, sound effects, as well as video and still images that go along with a live presentation. So in that 2.5-hour visit, I think folks get a really good idea about what this passion that we call sled dogs and sled dog racing is all about, as well as Iditarod. And we do try to include a little bit about the other aspects of our lives here in sort of what we call Bush Alaska, everything from hunting and gathering firewood to being 3 hours away from a grocery store.
Well, you couldn't be in a much better spot. I believe everybody that travels in Alaska on the road system probably drives right by your place. Is that right?
Yeah, that's about right. Yep. Yeah. We're about 30 miles south of Denali National Park, and you know, we do provide transportation for our tours throughout the summer months to and from all the area hotels as well.
And that is Doggone It Tours, and we'll make sure that we put a link on our page and your links to Facebook and all that. So, Mike, let's start talking about racing sled dogs. When did you get involved with mushing, and when did you think, you know, the Iditarod is one of those crazy things I want to try to tackle?
Yeah, well, I got involved with sled dogs in 1986, so it's been a long, long, strange trip, if I can steal that line from somebody else. But it wasn't very long after I got into sled dogs, even though I wasn't anywhere physically, financially, or even the capabilities of the dogs that I had at the time. It wasn't very shortly after I got involved with sled dogs that I heard about the Iditarod. It was definitely in the heyday of the Rick Swenson and Susan Butcher battles and in Iditarod, which totally lured me in. And it was certainly something that I was, you know, determined to do ever since, you know, I first heard about the Iditarod.
So this year you finished in 39th place, 11 days, 19 hours. And before we talk about this year's race itself, how did you feel going into it? Were you prepared? Did you have enough miles? Were the dogs looking good? Any hiccups along the way other than could be expected?
Yeah, no, you know, I felt very at ease with this year's Iditarod. I had a very veteran team, lots of 8, 9, and 10-year-olds in my team that had been and seen just about everything. They had certainly slowed down some, but they certainly had great conditioning all season. So I was very relaxed, you know, before the start and throughout the season, not really expecting anything too competitive out of the team I was driving. But very, very confident in the fact that they could do just about anything.
So how did you feel about the change in route? You know, they haven't had it up in Fairbanks for, I don't know, 12 years or so. It's only the second time leaving from there. Were you confident in that route? Had you traveled down that way since it's pretty much right in your backyard, just a few miles up the road to Nenana and that part of the country?
Yeah, you know, I very, very rarely, because we have such good snow, do I travel for training to many, many parts of the state. But I had traveled the Yukon River on a snow machine in 2008 from Nenana to Nome, so I was familiar with that in that respect. Certainly, there was lots of sections of trail that were different. You know, the trip going up to Hooslea and back down to Koyukuk, and I think there's very few people, involved with the Iditarod who have been on that those particular sections of trail. But you know, so much of what we do and the equipment that we use and the equipment that is required for us to carry all revolves around a magic four-letter word that starts with S, and that is snow. So I felt very good about the fact that you know, we were starting regardless where that start line may be or what the trail might entail as far as, you know, topography or, you know, temperature or whatever, having snow to run on is really kind of crucial, I think, to what we all do.
So did you were you part of that big weather system there near Manly and Hooslea where it was, you know, 50, 60, 70 below? And if you were, how did you handle that and how did the dogs handle it?
Yeah. No, I don't think anybody escaped that cold. I think there was some wind further along the race that, you know, those of us who were kind of in the middle or back of the pack, I think we experienced that wind a little bit longer. Or it hit us a little earlier in the race than it did the front runners. But I don't think anybody totally escaped that cold going up to Hooslea. I don't know if it was – there was a Connect 200 race several years back that was pretty darn close. Of course, that was a lot shorter. But it quite might possibly have been the coldest temperatures that I've ever run dogs in. And again, the dogs handled it remarkably well. And I think for most of us that were out there, it's sort of just like acting like a turtle. You know, you just try to pull yourself into your park as much as you can and try not to think about it too much. I remember, even though the little portages that kind of crisscross between the many miles on the river there going up to Hooslea, they don't gain elevation a whole lot, but I can remember how much warmer it felt every time you just climbed up out of that river, even if it was only a 15 or 20 foot elevation gain. It just felt remarkably warm, and almost by the time you crest the you know, that portage, you look and oh, here we go back down onto the river, and certainly could feel it as soon as you drop back down.
So when you're in that cold of a temperature, and I'm sure that 99.9% of the folks that listen to this have never been anything close to that, what do you prepare mm-hmm. yourself to wear, or going into it, do you dress any differently, or did you obviously you probably didn't know you were going to get smacked in the face with 70 degrees below zero when you started. What did you dress for when you felt that it was that cold out there and you had to prepare yourself?
Yeah, you know, I typically try to dress in a manner that allows me to sort of change, and utilizing a very simple, basic three-layered system. Certainly was definitely cold on that run. Again, was very grateful that you know, like I said, I didn't have really much or any really tinkering to do with dogs, and that's really kind of the critical, I think, part, or at least what I felt was very comfortable, is I just didn't have to stop a whole lot. I didn't have to do a whole lot. So I was able to, in those kind of temperatures, just keeping your mitts on, keeping your hood up, every time you have to take something off in order to do anything. Of course, you get quite a bit colder. It takes a heck of a lot longer to warm up. So again, just a very simple three-layer clothing system. I tend to wear pretty much what I have or what I'm taking from the start to the finish, and then just having the option of removing an outer layer if it turns out to be really warm. But certainly those temperatures, they're not comfortable by any stretch of the imagination. But again, just the experience of the dogs that I had with me, my experience, you know, just getting booties on right and jackets on right before we leave a checkpoint, allowed me to stay in my outer gear, throughout those runs and, you know, manage to stay comfortable.
So, Mike, we're talking to Mike Santos here today on Mushing Radio. Mike, you had mentioned that you have some older dogs on your team, 8, 9, 10-year-olds. And, of course,
yep,
that leads to a lot of experience. But Do you have to adjust any type of the way that you run your dogs when they are that much older than a lot of the competition? You know, you often hear of, you know, 3, 4, 5 year olds out there that are doing this race, and some of your dogs are almost double that.
Yeah, I don't know if there's anything I really have adjusted. They probably have adjusted themselves in some ways. They've just settled down, which in a lot of ways is just really, at least with my team, it has made it very comfortable and enjoyable to travel with. I mean, there's just so little headache or trouble. The speed has sort of self-regulated it, you know, itself. They've just slowed down a little bit due to the fact that they're a little older. But, you know, there wasn't anything. This was very trying. I did a ride on a weather perspective. You mentioned cold. We had lots of snow, and then we had lots of wind. So there was really 300-mile legs, basically. I think she was like to ride, and that was, you know, 300 miles of pretty cold temperatures, and followed by 300 miles of pretty good, you know, snow, followed by 300 miles of pretty good wind, at least where I was in the grand scheme of things, and it was just a lot of fun because the dogs, they don't blink, you know. They just kind of handled everything. Like, yeah, we've seen this before, you know, no problem.
We can handle this.
So
we have age on our side.
We've done this 100 times. You know? Yeah, yeah.
Cool.
We're not going to go as fast as everybody else, but you know, no problem. And like I say, it was enjoyable on that level to have a team that was just really that easy and comfortable to drive. And it was also just a personal sort of satisfaction. You know, every single one of these dogs was born and raised here, so I have a long history with these guys that are 9 and 10 years old, and for many of them, two have just retired to a retirement home in Sterling, Alaska, enjoying the couch. And so it was a lot of fun just spending sort of, you know, their last race with me in that manner.
So you finished, as we said, 39th place, which is firmly there in the middle of the pack. Did you feel pretty good about that? Or, you know, you often hear a lot of people thinking what they could have done different to raise up position or whatever. How did you feel coming into the finish there?
Yeah, no, I was very satisfied with where we finished. You know, I'm very much not in the school of trying to put my personal desires, perhaps, above what I think my dogs are capable of doing and doing well. I really, you know, have not ever entered an Iditarod with, I think, an unrealistic expectations. I think it's just such a thrill to travel across the state of Alaska with a group of dogs that you've raised and know well. And I've often said, you know, not only to other Iditarodders, but also many of our guests that come and visit in the summer, that, you know, there's just really no good way to lose an Iditarod. You know, you participate, and the experience is worth the price of admission, I guess you could say. So yeah, no, I'm tickled pink that I've had a chance here now. This what the third time that I've had a chance to actually compete in the Iditarod and be involved and get out there and just enjoy this state the way it was meant to be enjoyed, you know?
Exactly, for sure. So, Mike, it's been about a month now since you finished up and you're back home and preparing for spring, and I'm sure that the visitors that are going to make their way north here in the next couple of months, any changes? How do you feel about next season? What's your plans? What's on tap for Wolf Den Kennel there?
Yeah, you know, very, very interesting year for us, and a lot of it, again, has to do with the age of the dogs. But I have a very talented group of younger dogs, and I, like I say, have retired a couple already and probably will retire a few more of my older dogs, veteran dogs. So really up in the air. A lot, of course, has to do with how well we do financially this coming summer, but really on the fence of what we want to do next year. Do I spend next winter, you know, going back and running some of the 200- and 300-mile races in the state, you know, with a younger group of dogs, kind of getting them ready for the following season? Or do I try to, you know, incorporate some of the star JV players, if you will, and try to run Iditarod again next year? So really up in the air as far as our plans for next year. But, you know, I think 2 days after I got back, we were running dogs, harness breaking puppies. And nothing's really has changed in our day-to-day activities by any rate.
Sure. Mike, if we could touch on, you had mentioned the retirement homes for some of these guys, and you had mentioned that some of these older dogs are now in that retirement place and laying on the couch somewhere. How does a dog adjust to being in that life, and if they're 10 years old, 3,650 days there as a sled dog, now kicking it back on the couch watching soap operas? How do you think that a dog adjusts, and they do very well in that environment?
Yeah, you know, we are very, you know, selective on where our dogs go. So they're not on the couch 365 days a year.
Yeah.
So we purposely try to find very active, dog-oriented homes for these dogs. People that are either avid cyclists, skiers, or ski-joring, that kind of thing. So dogs still participate in the activities that they want to do. It's just at a much more laid-back manner. But as far as them being adaptable, you know, I think the Alaskan Husky is just blessed genetically with a remarkable ability to adapt to almost anything. And then, like I say, just their lifestyle with us, having been handed out to visitors in the summertime since the time they were 4 or 5 weeks old, all the way up through the amount of traveling we've done, not only in a truck, but in an airplane and to the different places and villages and people that we've encountered, and veterinarians and photographers and, you know, crowds in Anchorage for the ceremonial start. They really have seen and experienced a bunch. And, with our sort of and I'm not saying this myself particularly, but I think as us mushers and as a group, our sort of demeanor in those situations, the dogs look to us for guidance, and we look calm, and they're like, yeah, no problem. There's helicopters and people and kids screaming, and everything's just cool. So I think, like I say, I think they adapt really, really well to those homes, and like I say, by the time they do retire from a racing kennel, they're kind of looking forward to maybe just a little bit more one-on-one attention, still having the opportunity to exercise and participate in the sport that they love doing, and just at a little less intensity.
You know, that question comes up all the time, so I figured I would ask it when I did. Is, you know, a lot of people think that these dogs just mush till the end, and so many mushers do place their dogs in retirement homes, and they place them all over the world. You know, you hear folks sending dogs off to Germany and whatnot. So, yeah, I got to commend you on that and doing a pretty good screening process for those guys and making sure that they live out their lives in the best way possible. Mike, we have just a few minutes left. Anything else you want to mention? Anything else you want to talk about? Anybody you want to thank? You know, this is your show to talk about what you want.
Yeah, no, I think Iditarod itself needs to be commended for a remarkable job this year. I know that not only, some of the participants, but also some of our fans might have been a little bit disappointed after last year's Iditarod. And, hindsight is always a wonderful thing that we don't always have the ability to utilize. But, can't say enough about what the Iditarod did this year to ensure a very fun, safe race, not only for the participants, but I have to imagine that our fans we're very happy, just the number of people finishing, the size of the teams that were finishing. I think it's just a home run on every level. So, hats off to the folks, the Iditarod, and just having that extra challenge of the logistics being different than something that they're familiar with certainly add a little bit to their challenge as putting that race on. So, yeah, just hats off to the Iditarod, and really excited that they made that decision, and excited to go forward.
You know, I haven't heard any complaints from anyone with the change of route from any of the mushers or anybody that's been involved. So I think that it was a home run, as you said, on all points. It's got to be an utter nightmare to try to get everything changed at such the last minute, and it sounds like they did a great job.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And again, not only just the Iditarod, but the villages, some of them, the first time ever, you know, hosting an Iditarod, places like Huslia and Koyukuk. But they're no strangers to sled dogs and sled dog racing. So they certainly the cultural history of our lifestyle, I guess you will, or our sport is still well ingrained in these communities. And so they weren't totally green to what was going to happen and what to expect. But, you know, everybody really did step up to the plate. Even the city of Fairbanks, you know, just a remarkable job handling that many teams, even with the bum ice. So, you know, from start to finish, just world class on every level.
If we could swing back real quick, Mike, to the tour business, Doggone Tour, Doggone It Tours is the name of it. And again, we'll place a link on our page. When does that get rocking and rolling? I know that you probably still have some snow there. A lot of the visitors have not arrived yet. When do people really start coming in, and is it a reservation type system, or can people just stop in and see the program? How does that work?
So we do open. We coincide basically our opening with the area hotels, and nothing really here in the Denali borough gets started till about the 15th of May, and it runs generally till about the middle of September 15th. You know, that gives give or take a couple of days. So we are typically ready to roll somewhere around the 10th of May, and we don't shut down until we stop getting phone calls.
Right.
It is by reservation. But we offer four tours a day, 7 days a week, starting 8:30 in the morning, and the last one I think leaves here at about 9 o'clock at night. So if you're in Denali, you certainly have the opportunity to have you visit, see if we can have some fun together.
Very good stuff. Mike Santos is our guest today. WolfsDenKennels.com is the website for the racing team, and Doggone It Tours is his tour business that he operates in the off season. Mike, it's been a pleasure. Hope to talk again soon, okay?
Yep. Thank you very much, Robert.
Thank you. Mike Santos, Iditarod Musher, finishing up in 39th place this year. We'll talk to you guys next time. Goodbye.